Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 164, recorded on May 4th, 2022. The Cloud Pod swiftly moves its money to Google Cloud. Happy 4th of May to all of you. May the 4th be with you.
Very good. Nice. I forgot today was May the 4th.
Yes, awesome. Yes, it is.
It's, we should have done a Yoda show title.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's already complicated enough to come up with a show title. If we ever did bootleg episodes where we included like all of our jibber jabber before the episode and all of that, and people want to actually pay for that as a subscription, they could hear the pain and suffering that we go through coming up with a show title every week. But
I think we'd have to pay them to listen to that.
Yeah, I mean, it might not work out. It might be a reverse money thing. Well, we are missing Peter. Peter also, like Ryan, did not file his vacation request in triplicate. So we have suspended him without pay for 2 weeks, and he'll be back hopefully after that. Or he'll just quit. I'm not really sure because we're in this anti-work culture right now where we just quit over things. So try not to text him while he's on vacation. He may get upset. I can't promise you anything. So there you go.
I'll keep an eye on anti-work to see if he posts anything there.
Exactly. Well, it is our favorite time of the quarter. Once again, it is earnings season. Every time.
Wow.
But you wish you hadn't turned those headphones up tonight. Or turned your car audio off. All right. Well, up first was Amazon. They had a rough quarter with a net loss of $3.8 billion on the quarter, basically because they overbuilt their supply chain and because they lost a ton of money on Rivian. Maybe you don't invest in a Rivian truck that doesn't exist. But if they had not invested in Rivian, they still would have only had profit of $3.8 billion, which was still down from $8.9 billion a year ago. And that was all on revenue that was up 7% to $116.4 billion. Could you imagine earning $116.4 billion and then still losing money on the day, end of the day? Like, unfathomable.
Yeah. No, it's crazy town.
Yeah, crazy. Like, how are you, like, what are you spending money on? Like, geez, it's crazy. AWS revenue, though, the most important part of this, was up 37% to $18.4 billion, with $6.5 billion of that coming to the bottom line as operating income, contributing to help make Amazon's loss not quite so bad. AWS's run right now is $73 billion with a B. When do you think they're across 100? Do you think it's this year? Or do you think it's next year?
At this rate, it could be this year, like end of this year.
Yeah, like if you look at the earnings report, the amount of deferred revenue they're carrying is like $70 billion on its own, which is all the commitments all of us have made in enterprise agreements. So yeah. There's a lot of money committed in uncommitted spend that has not been spent yet. So quite a bit.
Yeah. Because I don't know how much you think about the holiday shopping season and Prime Day, which is probably still coming up, and those types of things affect the AWS revenue. But it's got to be a big increase as other retailers use Amazon services to boost their sales.
You'd think so. Or they run away to Azure or to Google because Amazon's evil.
It could be.
And they don't like them. So yeah. It's one of the two ways. Well, Google earnings were up 23% to $68 billion. But of course, they missed it by 0.11 billion. And so the market was unhappy with them, particularly, though, because they're worried about YouTube advertising, which was down. But Google Cloud revenue, again, what we only care about, was up to $5.82 billion versus $5.76 billion a year before. Google Cloud grew 44% in the quarter, but is still losing money, but only $931 million lost versus $974 million lost a year ago. So they found roughly $43 million. So hey, it's good. Good for them.
I mean, I'm all for YouTube advertising being down because I just pay for enough services and I just refuse to pay for one more. So I watch all the YouTube ads like every 15 minutes. So if, people stop buying that advertising, great.
I just paid for YouTube Red and don't ever see them ever, which is the best way. It's worth every penny to me not to see those dumb ads for whatever video game with the little orcs that are fighting each other. I don't even know what the game is. So I've seen it.
It's probably a fake game.
Or the games where they're like, yo, you're going to go on this game and you're going to like repair your bathroom and like fix it up. And then you actually download the game and it's like, no, it's a puzzle matching game that you had to earn stars to do the thing that we sort of said you do in the thing. But it isn't anything like the preview you actually saw. I've only been burned by my children doing this like several times. Like, I want to buy this game. And then it's not the game they thought it was. So
yeah,
got to love it. And then last but not least is Microsoft earnings. Their revenue was $49.4 billion, an increase of 18%, an operating income of $20.4 billion, which was an increase of 19%. Of course, in the Asia world, Asia was up 32% year over year. They are part of the $19.1 billion of the Intelligent Cloud business unit, which had an overall 26% increase. So clearly driven mostly by Asia, but also growing quite nicely on the Microsoft Asia side. Of course, the stock market hated all of this and punished all of them with lots of losses and red. And so the CloudPod stock finance portfolio is definitely not doing well today.
It's hard to call a 32% increase for Azure earnings a slowdown, but it is, you know, definitely slower than what they saw in 2021 and the boom of the pandemic. But, I think it's the overall trend is everyone's going to keep adopting cloud hyperscalers to host their infrastructure.
Yeah. I mean, it's still better than Netflix. Yeah, they just had an absolute cliff when they announced their subscription drops. Yeah. So, I'll take this over that.
Yeah.
It's pretty tough in Netflix though when they lose customers because of restrictions on trade with countries like Russia.
I think if it was legitimately a situation where they lost exactly the number of users they had in Russia, people would have said okay. But even factoring that out of it, they lost quite a few subscribers. Russia was a good excuse for them, but not the only factor. All right, let's move on to AWS news this week. Amazon. MSK serverless is now generally available. Of course, this reduces the overhead of managing your Kafka and simplifies the planning and scaling story by making it AWS's problem, which is the best problem to have. MSK serverless automatically provisions and manages the required resources to provide an on-demand streaming capacity and storage for your applications. It is the perfect solution to get started with a new Apache Kafka workload where you don't know how much capacity you will need, or if your application produces unpredictable or highly variable throughput, and you don't want to pay for idle capacity. Each MSK serverless cluster provides you up to 200 megabits per second of write throughput and 400 megabits per second of read throughput, and it allocates up to 5 megabits per second of write throughput and 10 megabits per second of read throughput per partition.
I probably still have to be like somewhat smart about my Kafka enablement and know like the number of consumers and number of events and those types of things. I can't just completely remove myself, right? Because that's what I really want. I want a PubSub model where I just don't have to think about anything. Just do it.
Or you could just use Kinesis.
The problem with new users is that they may make mistakes, and you don't want to accidentally scale a cluster up to bazillions of dollars versus a slow, controlled growth where you say, okay, we're reaching a limit, let's increase it a little bit. So you don't have to budget. I mean, how do you budget with a system that infinitely auto scales?
I mean, these things aren't noticed until stuff stops working anyway. So I don't know, like. It'd be nice if, it was easier to detect those slow increases and hit a budget and have a warning at this threshold and then before it hits failures. But I don't know, maybe I'm doing too many things, but it's always like, oh, that's on fire. I'll go attend to that. But, MSK versus managing a Kafka service and having to provide this, raw, I'll take a managed service any day, especially regarding Kafka.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's worth twice its weight in gold.
Yeah. Yes. What does this cost? I will double it. I'm actually having this exact same conversation right now because I'm like, managing Kafka, not so great. Why don't we go talk to Confluent about doing this for us on GCP instead? Yeah. And then we just use the partner because that's what Google's good for, is using the partners to plug right into your VPC. Then magic happens and I don't worry about it.
Is it fully managed? I mean, it's a little off topic, but I thought Confluent was just sort of a supported.
No, I mean, if you're buying the SaaS service from Confluent, it's a SaaS application from Confluent. So it's, endpoints and topic creation, and then they handle a lot of the heavy lifting for you. This is why Confluent was mad at Amazon, because they built MSK versus partnering with them to resell their product instead.
Okay.
So yeah, if you're on Azure or GCP, you just go to Confluent and you pay them money instead of GCP. So there you go. Well, if you need a new instance sizes because you needed more disk throughput, Amazon has you this week with the new L4i instances powered by the latest generation Intel Xeon Scalable Ice Lake processors with an all-core turbo frequency of 3.5 gigahertz. Instances can offer up to 30 terabytes of NVMe storage using AWS Nitro SSD devices that are custom built for AWS and designed to minimize latency and maximize transactions per second. Apparently, this is a great solution for SQL or NoSQL databases. And the L4i lets you get two vCPU and 16 memory with 468 gigabytes of local NVMe disk, 350 megabits of read throughput, and up to 10 gigabytes of EBS and network bandwidth, all the way up to the L4i 32X large, which gives you 128 vCPU, a terabyte of RAM, 30,000 gigabytes of NVMe storage, 22,400 megabytes of sequential read throughput, and 40 gigabits of EBS optimized bandwidth, and 75 gigabytes of networking bandwidth. Available to you in US East 1, 2, US West 2, Ireland, and that is it for right now. But available on demand and spot, so you can play with it on a cheaper price. And I have a quote here from Yiftach Shulman, co-founder and CTO of Redis. We are thrilled with the performance we are seeing from the Amazon EC2 L4i instances, which use the new low-latency AWS Nitro SSDs. Our testing shows L4i instances deliver an astonishing 2.9x higher query throughput than the previous generation L3 instances. We have also tested with various read and write mixes and observed consistent and linearly scaling performance.
You know, there's still a whole team of DBAs that doesn't think this is good enough, though. I just know it.
Wait till they see SQL Server 2021.
Is 2021 next or is 2022?
That's a massive instance. Yeah, oh, who knows? I've given up caring about that anymore.
Perfect. Three.
Everyone I know is still using 2016 or things like that.
2014, 2012, 2008. So. You know what? Why upgrade to the new ones when I can live in the past before COVID with my SQL Server? Yeah. Perfect.
It was a happier time.
That it was. All right. AWS has added a management feature that was for a thing I thought they'd never update, which is EC2 key pairs. Those not on board with the new hotness of using SSM for everything, EC2, a key pair are the security credentials that you use to prove your identity when connecting to an Amazon EC2 instance, which is also not great. You should use SSO. But Windows PuTTY users rejoice because customers can now create an EDS25519 key pair in PPK format. And AWS has also announced that you will now be able to view additional metadata like creation date and new API to fetch the public key material. And all that really matters about this is that Windows part. Because not having to do the lookup of the Google, like how do I convert a PEM file to a PPK every freaking time I send a key to a Windows person, they're like, I can't use this in PuTTY. And I'm like, oh, son of a... And then I have to go find this and I have to complain about it every time. So the fact that after 10 years of Amazon usage, they fixed this problem, I am ecstatic.
That's funny. I've seen so many websites out there. Paste your key in here. We'll give you the PPK format. Like, really? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty crazy.
The method is interesting.
Like clockwork, I have to do this like every 6 weeks. Like this, there's, you know, someone who doesn't understand why this connection isn't working. And there's nothing like troubleshooting an SSH failure on, a Windows user, especially as someone like myself who uses a Mac. You know, it's already hard enough. So this is fantastic.
Yeah, but now we have metadata on the key pairs, which means the information security teams can say, oh, this key has been around for X many months or X many weeks. It's time to rotate it. So now we need a whole bunch more automation or just forget all that and just use SSM.
Yeah, that'd be
ideal. But I mean, the nice thing is that now you have this metadata and you can automatically generate a PPK file. You could, in theory, write a plugin for PuTTY that would do that for you automatically.
Speaking of things that never get updated, PuTTY is one of those things as well. Like the website still looks like it was built in 1993.
It is. 1993 is about right. Yeah. They're like no graphics. Like what would we do with graphics? That's just crazy talk.
Yeah.
And to be in all honesty, that's about my level of HTML as well. So yeah, I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I got lost interest at CSS. I was like, yeah, this sucks. I don't want to do this. So I got out of it. The 0.76, I'm just curious, was released in July 2021, which means it's probably due for a security vulnerability any moment. So, because of course it's an open source project that hasn't been maintained properly by two guys in a garage who have no web experience. So clearly it's Jonathan and Ryan. Glad to know.
Wow, you know, I thought HashiCorp had the record for not reaching version one of anything. But this may actually take the win.
Actually, I didn't put that together, but now that you mention it, yeah, I think they do have. I think they have HashiCorp's number. The release page only goes back to 0.45, which was released in January 22nd, 1999. So there's many versions before that that were before that date. So yeah, that's that definitely is older than HashiCorp.
You think that 99 is the last time they had to change their, you know, their hosting provider because it didn't support their version of PHP?
I mean, 99 is it PHP? I mean, I think it literally is HTML. Like, I don't think there's anything else to it. They also got to the CSS part of the book and they were like, yeah, this is hard. We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
Long live the blink tag and call it a day. All right. Well, moving to GCP, the Cloud CISO perspective for April 2022 is here. And I'm only really talking about it because they are pimping the Google Cloud Security Summit, which is coming up very quickly. And if you don't stay to the end of the show to know that it's coming, it's worth going to, I'm sure, May 17th, the Google Cloud Summit. This is your last chance to register. Got invited to it today. I signed up. I will go see what they have to say. I'm excited. But you did highlight some of the recent releases. Many of these we have talked about on the show already. The Secure Data Warehouse Blueprint to allow you to make sure that your customers achieve better security through their shared fate vision, which is some new branding that I've noticed from Google, where it's no longer the shared security model. It's the shared fate vision model. So that's a little fun.
We're both
automatic
down.
DLP for BigQuery. We talked about that on the show. The new Chronicle MSSP program. So this is similar to what you get with Amazon's security product. You can now ingest a ton of partners' data into your Chronicle to make it less worthwhile. And then, of course, API management improvements to Apigee. Lots of good use cases came out this month, especially around confidential VMs and healthcare. And then managed cloud key encryption, which we talked about here on the show previously as well, all highlighted in this month's Cloud CISO Perspective. Well, if you are an SAP customer, you know that they have gotten along with Google tremendously well. In fact, I think Google may be SAP's preferred cloud provider because Amazon never bought SAP products. They were an Oracle financial shop, so SAP is still bitter. That's how I see it, but never know. But they did last year announce that the SAP BTP, or the Business Technology Platform, would become available on top of Google, and that got released last year. And Google's here now to tell us about the four use cases that customers are getting great benefit from. And so I thought I'd share them with you as well. So the first one was timely insights from combining data from SAP and non-SAP solutions, which is basically a data warehouse. Really novel. Super great. I'm sure you like that. Then the most cost-effective marketing through SAP ERP correlation, which basically says if your marketing team uses Google Marketing to buy ads, now you can track that spend directly in SAP BTP and the Google Marketing Platform. So you get now control of your marketing spend directly from SAP. The accelerated innovation in core systems with containerized apps, which means you can leverage GKE for BTP, which that's a bunch of acronyms. I don't know what they mean. But containers for you, containers for me, containers for everybody. Simplified operations, Google Search, and SAP Workzone, which means that Google is now embedded into your ERP, and now you know why they shorted your stock. Let them in the door. Well done, man. And then the last one, extended SAP process automation with Google services and APIs, which of course is workflow management, robotic process automation, AI through no code. What could go wrong?
And drag and drop. Yeah.
You broke the compliance of your financial system because you put the no code in the wrong place because you didn't know what you were doing. Great. Compliance nightmare of no code. I can't wait for that. It's going to be a thing. Call it here now.
Like some crumb on somebody's desk on their mouse mount or something, and they're dragging the mouse across and accidentally gets jammed on there, and all of a sudden you've sent nuclear warheads to the wrong place or something.
Yeah. I hope a lot of these no-code platforms have like very good revision histories and the ability to restore previous versions and diffs, and because that's the biggest pain point of these things is, you know, it's like, what? You know, you get 27 step changes in and you realize that you need to revert back but still maintain some of those changes. Like, it's so painful. And, you know, fortunately, we have IDEs and Git and all kinds of other stuff for code where it makes it a little easier, but not so much in some of these no-code solutions. Yeah. Nightmare fuel.
Yep. I saw someone on Twitter mention that there was a lot of new stuff coming to Honeycode soon, and I was like, oh, these are going to cover it on the show. we haven't talked about Honeycode in forever.
Yeah, I can do what Ryan does the thing, but it's not going to be pretty because it's painful.
I tried
and failed.
Maybe they'll fix all your issues with the new things that are coming out in the next quarter.
I doubt it.
Well, if you want to build your cloud skills on the Google Cloud, of course, they are offering you for the month of April or end of April through May 29th, the cloud training on Coursera for 1 month free, which gives you access to over 500 Google Cloud self-paced labs available through Coursera. Learners can choose their preferred format to claim 1 month of free access to either a top Google Cloud project, course, specialization, or professional certification track. So I need to do this just because I'm now doing a lot more GCP, and I should probably get certified just so I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, good idea.
You just want to flaunt it. I know you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. What do you mean you don't have a GCP certification? How long have you worked here? I got mine. What's wrong with you? No.
Mm-hmm. Hey, everyone. Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the Cloud Pod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008. They are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
Well, Google Cloud is collaborating with Swift. This is not the programming language. This is the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, which has secured financial messaging for banks, corporations, brokers, and treasuries in over 200 countries. For example, if you ever did a bank transfer with a friend or relative who used a different bank in another country because they told you they're from Nigeria and you could earn a lot of money, it's likely that those payment messages went right through Swift. They delivered that fraud right to your doorstep. Swift recently announced their new solution, Alliance Connect Virtual, which in the cloud age is a terrible name, which enables our customers to connect to a Swift network directly from the public cloud. Alliance Connect Virtual is a new network connectivity solution that enables Swift customers to deploy traditional physical hardware-based Swift VPN connections as virtual appliances in the public cloud. And previously, you had to put Swift infrastructure on-premise or in a colo facility, or can swim Swift via third party for a lot of money. If this is something you're looking to do with Google Cloud, they are creating a reference implementation of Swift components on the Google Cloud to help mutual customers satisfy Swift security and operational requirements, increase their operational efficiency, and accelerate adoption of cloud for their core payment applications. And all of this reference material will come out later this year in parallel with the general availability launch of Alliance Connect Virtual. Why didn't they make it Alliance Connect Cloud? I don't understand. But here we are.
I think the important, I mean, it's great, this is wonderful, but the important thing about this is that it's signaling a change in compliance controls, because all these financial organizations were very traditionally physical hardware in a rack in the data center, and there was no way to move it to the cloud. And so but whether it's through advocacy or whether it's just through proof of process, being able to virtualize all these things is going to be huge and will open up a massive market for new customers.
Absolutely. You took the words right out of my mouth. Like, this is I don't know if it's how many this year, but there's just a slew of financial institutions moving to cloud. NASDAQ announced at reInvent, you know, Swift, like these big names in the financial space. And I don't know if it's, you know, by leveraging stuff like the shared security fate in GCP, where, you know, their compliance concerns and large cloud compliance teams can work with other compliance teams and how to evidence these things. But this is going to be fantastic for those regulated workloads.
Things you never thought you'd say 20 years ago. Fantastic, yeah. For regulated workloads. Or what interesting people we've turned into.
Boring man. What has happened to me? I mean, compliance controls.
Yeah. We were excited about PPK earlier.
I know.
That's how we're getting old. All right. Well, Azure has new ways to invest your money to help accelerate your move to Azure. To help entice your user to migrate to Azure, Microsoft is offering you 3 additional years of extended security updates for SQL Server 2012 and SQL Server 2012 R2, or Windows Server 2012 and 2012 R2, giving you more time to modernize supported applications beyond the 10 years granted by Microsoft support.
Granted, huh?
I'm still not sure I like creating a premium class of Microsoft user, especially since it's security updates.
Yeah, this is, you know, like, I get why a cloud provider would do something like this, right? They can provide and sort of guarantee the security of things because it's running in an Azure workload with, you know, defense in depth and a lot of risks mitigated. But I just think it's weird, you know, like shady baseball, which is not a term, I just made it up, to offer incentive for running an ancient non-modern platform. you know, and something, if you're running SQL 2012 and struggling to update, is this so you can just buy more time to get to the cloud, like, or put off? You know, I don't know. Like, it just rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, you'd think it'd be better to invest in modernization and helping people with migrations than supporting this whole system.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, you get people locked into SQL Server 2012 and tell them that the only way forward now is to move to the Azure cloud if they want to continue to run it and have security updates. So it's a little underhanded feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just annoying because you can only get this on the Azure cloud. So, you're probably already baked into this terrible scenario because of Microsoft in some way. Like, I'm sure it's their fault. It's always their fault that you're stuck on this old version. Like, and now they're like, well, you know, we'll give you an extra 3 years before we cut you off. It's like a cocaine drip. Like, we'll give you one more hit, man. Give you one more hit. You don't have to do that update modernization program you hate. And then it gets deprioritized, defunded in another 2 years. And then all of a sudden, like, 1 year left. And like, how do we screw this up again?
Yeah.
It happens every time. Because it gets deprioritized now. So why would you do it?
And you're even further out of date, right? Because the new hotness is whatever the more recent version is, which is even more incompatible with whatever you're doing. And like, it's this never-ending cycle.
And then you got some guy who's like, well, we don't know how it's going to perform on SQL 2025 because we've never tested it there before. And, you know, it's all this unknown and risk that we're going to take into the business. And it's like, yeah, but you're taking all this risk by being on this garbage old thing, too. It's bad.
Yeah.
Obviously, huge regressions in performance over the lifetime of the product. I mean, I don't know why people think that. Isn't it weird that people get stuck on these old versions, though? I kind of wonder if it's a sign that they tried to use a tool for the wrong thing, or they tried to use it for the capabilities that didn't have. You know, they can't migrate off because they needed replication, which wasn't supported the way it needed to be. And there's lots of reasons why they kind of find themselves in this box. And it's unfortunate.
I think it's funny because I don't see this as much. You still see it a little when on software that's built primarily upon open source, because you're sort of a victim, or at least a passenger on that ride when you're using open source. You have no idea. You're on your own hook for support and you're on the community. And so you sort of build your software to sort of deal with that, right? You're not going to push the edges and customize it too much because you know that this might die. So you're going to have to rip it out someday. But something like SQL Server, the houses that I've seen use that, like, it is completely customized. Every single knob is turned and tweaked and made so that it's customizable. And then those are the applications that can't go to the next version of this because that weird WYSIWYG thing doesn't exist in the new version. Like, it's a really interesting pattern.
Yeah, it's like they removed a feature because it was causing problems elsewhere, but people depended on that feature.
Right.
Yeah.
And the crappy performance that that feature provided, right? Like that, like they coded around it somehow.
Yep.
Crazy.
Yep. Well, the general availability of object replication on premium blob storage and rule limit is increased. The replication now supports premium block blobs. Replicate your data from your blob container and one storage account to another anywhere in Azure. You now specify up to 1,000 replication rules, increased from 10 previously, for each replication policy for both general purpose V2 and premium block blob storage accounts. If you need 1,000 replication rules, seek help, but is limited to 10. Does feel like Azure was limiting this until they could provide the solution at scale.
Yeah, that's a lot of replication rules.
We should let you write all the show notes because these are great jokes. Like, so much better than mine.
It's funny watching you trip over my words because I don't write in the same. I don't write in your voice yet. Yeah, it's a talent. I don't have.
Mostly because I'm like, is this a joke or is this real? I'm trying to like decipher it as I read it out loud to you. Yeah. And so
because I'm not funny.
You should just put a random question mark at the end of a sentence and see if he raises his voice.
Right. Well, he had it here. I didn't read it because I thought he was going to use it as a joke. So I was trying to save it for him. What is premium block blob? No idea. But is someone how better and more expensive than general purpose V2 storage? Which is true. I have no idea what that is either. But it's the blob, and it's replicating 1,000 times more aggressively now than 10 times before. Can't go well for anybody.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the next article was clearly written by a nerd because he opens the entire article with threat intelligence at scale. And yes, that was with an exclamation point at the end.
Pushes my glasses up on the bridge of my nose.
Yes. Article goes on to talk about all the ways they've been evolving WAF to help their customers address their security challenges with their cloud-native self-managed security service to protect your applications and APIs running in Azure or anywhere else from network edge to cloud. Apparently there are.
Breathe. Breathe. Just.
Apparently there are two flavors of WAF: global WAF, which attaches to the front door, and regional WAF that attaches to the Azure application gateways. Now, I want to talk about this for a second, because why is the global one the front door? Because I don't think of a front door as global, but yet the regional one is the Azure application gateway, which makes me sound like more like an airplane gateway. So I feel like this is named backwards. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I think of global as the edge, right? Like that's where you want to be close to your end users. And while I do understand having, you know, web access firewall rules and protections at that layer, not a front door for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I like the visualization of the front door. It's a good idea, but like now you're just messing it up. Like you're just screwing it all up now. So they go on to tell you what's changed in the security WAF area, and that is improved security posture rule sets, because everyone likes more rules. Anomaly scoring with reduced false positives, because again, if you're making it sound like everything's bad, I don't like you. Increased size limits, API security, advanced customization with per rule exclusions, bot protection, because everyone likes to hide it from the bots. Improved performance, increased scale, which are things you're not really features, they're just things your server should do. Better protections, richer feature sets, improved management with native consistent experience with a WAF policy, whatever a native consistent WAF policy is, advanced analytics capabilities, built-in security reports, and improved manageability. Again, something the cloud provider should just provide out of the box. So there you go once again.
I do feel like about halfway through that list, the writer sort of just started making stuff up.
Yeah, that's where I feel that way, doesn't it?
Better perfection, richer features. I don't know. It makes toast.
Indeed, indeed. Well, that is it for new news this week. And we are off to the lightning round without Peter. So there'll be no score once again. And we will try to attempt to read these to each other and not laugh in the process, which is sometimes challenging. So we'll see how we do.
All right,
Jonathan, I put your name first because I mean like that. So
I see. That's because that's the only one I had a funny joke for. So
I can fix it for you.
No, right. No, it's fine. It's fine.
Ryan. This is going to mess up the order later. So not
change the I didn't have a funny joke. I was just, okay. It's going to be very disappointing now.
Yeah. Better have a pretty good joke for the other one. All right, starting us off, Amazon RDS Data API now supports returning SQL queries as simplified JSON string.
I mean, how are we going to train developers to write microservices now if they're not converting SQL to JSON anymore as their first project?
Hmm. Well, like any good hazing, right? Missing that semicolon, that'll teach them.
I didn't have anything for this. I was just trying to make you feel bad.
I mean, if you're already taking the data as JSON and you're inserting it as JSON through this data API, couldn't you just put it in S3 and call it a day? Like, does this really need it to be SQL? Like, I mean, that's the other side of this. I don't understand.
Public preview. Static web app support for preview environments in Azure DevOps.
I mean, DevOps, automation, lots of configuration, lots of coding. Static web apps, really simple, super easy to do, can do with a Jenkins pipeline. How do these relate to each other?
Yeah, I got nothing.
Wait, what I don't get is if it's a static web page, surely the preview is going to be the same as the file and product anyway, just deploy to prod.
Yeah.
true. Amazon Relational Database Service on AWS Outposts now supports storage autoscaling.
Because, yes, I've moved all this compute and storage into my data center so that I can have it scale automatically. Wait, that won't work.
That's kind of weird. Like, just one day you rock up at work at 9 a.m. and there's a truck pulling up with a whole new rack of disks or something. Like, oh, who ordered that? Thanks, Amazon.
That'd be sweet if that's the way it works.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah. But I'm more concerned about the person who's like, okay, so we bought AWS Outpost to burn money. And then we said we're going to run RDS on top of it to burn more money. And then we're going to let it just automatically scale its storage to burn even more money.
And cause an outage.
And cause an outage.
You're going to run out of that auto-scaling storage, and then the whole thing's going to fall down.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's great. This is a great way to burn a lot of money and get yourself fired for an outage. That's really great.
Yeah.
Amazon RDS now supports IPv6.
Nothing else does, so no worries.
My light bulb.
Just your Kubernetes clusters that you forced into IPv6. That's all.
Yeah, my light bulb can now talk to RDS, apparently. Awesome.
Only if you put it on the public internet, though. I mean, like that's the trade-off you got to make.
Yeah, I don't look forward to debugging the JDBC drivers that do not support IPv6 for this connection. AWS Snow Family now enables you to remotely monitor and operate your connected Snowball Edge devices.
I'm mostly sad this didn't get shipped in January, because then I could have gone to Tahoe, I could have gone to the Powder, I could have been in the snow managing my Snow Edge. Like, I could have had snow all day long.
This is one of those features. I'm like, how did this work before? Like, you just
get to be in the data center,
plugged the thing into the wall and prayed for the best.
You had to be in the data. I gotten one of these from Amazon, the small teeny tiny one to play with, and Jonathan played with it too. You know, it basically plugs into your computer. You have to attach it to a computer to manage the damn thing. So now you don't have to do that, which is nice. So I do appreciate that part. Once it gets an IP, I assume you then connects to the console and you can connect it remotely. So you don't download the Snow software either, which was kind of annoying. I actually just deleted it from my Mac the other day because I was like, oh, I still have that Snow software that I haven't updated in months. So yeah, got rid of that.
So like, if you're monitoring the status of these devices, if they're failing, do they turn into yellow snow?
These are questions I can't answer, but excellent.
I love a good, like, I don't know, is that a dad joke? I guess it's close enough. Like, yeah.
Close enough, yeah.
It's verging on Beavis and Butthead, but, you know.
I mean, Beavis and Butthead lines moved.
It's about my level of humor.
We're good. Amazon Code Guru Reviewer now supports suppression of files and folders in code reviews, which must be a PFR from Ryan.
Don't look at this. Put it in this folder. Don't look at this. This is exactly my feature request.
That's amazing. I thought it said oppression of files and folders to begin with. Like,
help, I'm being oppressed.
Stay in your place. AWS AppConfig feature flag Lambda extension announces support for ARM Graviton 2 processors.
Much like the earlier announcement about static apps and Azure DevOps, these are things that don't make sense together. Why does a feature flag have anything to do with ARM Graviton processors? Like, aren't they completely isolated things?
Yeah, this makes me feel like I don't know what AppConfig does. I know I barely understand what a Lambda extension does. And I really don't know why any of that has anything to do with Graviton. So maybe I should just give up computers and go like farm alpacas. Just getting out of my depth.
Alpacas or emus? I don't know. Emus make good burgers.
Alpacas are pains in the asses. It seems more fitting for me.
It does seem more fitting for you.
Like, they bite and spit, you know? My life would be hell. All right. Amazon RDS Performance Insights now allows you to more easily see metrics for any time interval.
Except for the moment when the SQL Server was 100% CPU and I lost all the data because it couldn't report it to the Insight. But yeah, the data I needed. But, you know, sure. Thanks, Amazon. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the moment the decision was made to use SQL Server and see what the hell was going on back then.
Yeah. Does Performance Insights offer a time travel option?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of companies chose SQL Server when, you know, probably back in the, I don't know, the early 2000s, probably SQL 2000 was kind of the big time it broke out. Because SQL 7 was kind of garbage. And if I go back to SQL 2000 days, like, your choices were MySQL, Oracle, Sybase, Informix.
Oh,
yeah. Like, there was a lot of bad choices then. So, I mean, like, of the bad choices they could have made, like, most Windows people would never touch MySQL those days because that was a foreign concept to them, open source. So, like, SQL Server kind of is the default option out of those bunch if you're a Windows admin, because none of those other things you know how to use because they all require Linux. Or Unix.
I think Microsoft are in the position they're in today because they built out that developer network 25, 30 years ago. I still have a box that the CDs came in from MSDN. I've still got SQL Server 2000, Windows 2000, the entire suite of software that you can use in a limited capacity. And how easy is it just to start using something because it's already there on your desktop ready to go? I mean, mm-hmm. it's the equivalent of AOL sending CDs out to, you know, everybody.
Yeah,
I mean, it was definitely Microsoft's operating play, you know, and they did it up until they got sued in Europe for antitrust, you know, like, but it's, you know, it is a solid feature and I, you know, it continues to work today just in smaller examples. But yeah, I'll gladly use something that's readily available and right in front of me if I can make it work. Because when you're in that mode and you're just in like writing and creating, you're not really necessarily thinking about the life cycle of 20 years later when you have to upgrade this thing.
This will be somebody else's problem by the time that happens.
And then it's still yours. You're like, oh no, I've made some poor choices.
Well, that is it for Lightning Round. I don't think any of us won, for sure.
None of us lost, though.
Yeah.
And I'm glad Peter wasn't here. I think some of us would have lost points this week.
Yeah.
Wasn't so great. Yeah. Well, there are things coming up. Would you guys like to try to tell the listeners about things coming up, or do you want me to do it as usual? Put you guys on the spot.
Oh, I mean, you're going to ask me if I want to do work? You know the answer to that. No.
Well, yeah. No answer is no. I always drone on about these things. There's a whole list of things here we don't talk about every week. Maybe there's one here that you're excited about that I haven't talked about. I want to give you the opportunity to say your piece.
Well, I am interested in going to the Google Security Summit on May 17th. I will say that you mentioned it earlier and I had forgotten about it. And so that's coming up pretty quick. And so I'm glad to mention it. And that should be right after this show comes out.
Yep. Should be right after that. There's also the Microsoft one, though. I don't know if I'm going to go to that one, but that one's also coming out very quickly. And then, you know, KubeCon is big. And then, you know, Black Hat's coming up in August. That one intrigues me just because I kind of want to go buy a burner laptop that I then dip an ass when I get back, because I don't trust it ever to touch any of my computers at home. But yeah, like, I mean, there's definitely things coming up. Google Cloud Next, October 11th through 13th. And then right after that, it's going to be Oracle Cloud World in Vegas, which they announced pre-pandemic. They were going to move to Vegas, and they never got to do it. So that'll actually be happening, allegedly.
Is it in person? It must be, right?
I would assume so, all the way in October. I mean, unless another variant comes. I mean,
right.
you just never know, because, you know, like China right now shut down again. Yeah. And if you booked your trip to Reinforce, I did see registration open for that now in Boston, of course, June 28th to 29th. So there's lots of things coming up. Oh, and Remars open up for registration if you want to go learn about robots in Vegas. With like cool people from Amazon, you could do that too at Remars in June. So lots of things coming up as usual. All right. Well, I guess that's it for our week in the cloud. I'll let you guys go. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks.
Will do.
See you next time.
Yeah. Bye, everybody.
And that is the week in cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #thecloudpod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions.